29th. We're definitely into summer here in D.C. It's just like a sauna outside, even at this hour of the day, and air quality is terrible. So I'm sitting inside, shivering in the air conditioning in my sweater, which seems wrong. Welcome to Electric Politics. I'm George Kenney. Today's show switches the schedule around a little. Instead of Jean Bricmont, in keeping with last week's conversation about Israel and Palestine, and in order not to get too far away from the 40th anniversary of the event, I've substituted in a conversation with Captain Ward Boston about the USS Liberty. I know Jean won't mind, but Diana, please don't be mad at me. We talk for an hour and 14 minutes. Let's listen. Today, I'm very honored to have as my guest Captain Ward Boston, Jr., United States Navy, retired. Captain Boston served as chief counsel to the Navy's Court of Inquiry into the June 8, 1967 Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. He also served as a naval aviator in World War II on the carrier Yorktown, and later as an FBI agent prior to his assignment to the Navy's Judge Advocates General Corps. He is a graduate of the College of William and Mary School of Law and a resident of Coronado, California. Welcome to Electric Politics, Captain Boston.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, the other day when we were talking, you told me a little bit more about your background, which, if you could please, let's go over that again, because there's nothing really that I could find on the web that described all of this interesting detail. Explain how you got started with the Navy in the first place.
Well, George, I was a student of music prior to World War II. I had worked for several years trying to reach a level that I thought I would be accepted in the Curtis Institute of Music, but I didn't have the proper person to study with until Harold Gomberg came to the St. Louis Symphony as a principal oboist. Mm-hmm. And I wrote him a note and asked if I could study with him, and he answered and said, come down and be auditioned and he'd see. Well, I went down to St. Louis, 187 miles away. My father was a locomotive engineer on the Wabash Railroad, so I had a pass I could go without paying on the fare. Mm-hmm. And after the audition, he said, well, apparently you have some talent, but everything you know is wrong. You're going to have to start over and play sustained tones and scales for 1 year. And I thought, boy, that's going to be a headache. But it's worth it, I said, so I did it. And after a year, he said I'd reached a level that I could audition at Curtis, which I was then about 18, I think, or maybe 17 and a half, or that age. So I jumped on the train, went back to Curtis at the time that they were opening an audition. Now, if you're aware of Curtis Institute of Music, you don't pay to go there. You have to have some kind of a talent. Well, I'm not really that bright or that sharp. My mental acumen doesn't equal people like Leonard Bernstein and other people went there, but I had the mechanical ability, apparently, which I learned from Harold Gomberg. Mm-hmm. And I was the only oboist applicant that was accepted that year from all over the country. And there were quite a few trying to get in from L.A. and New York, Pittsburgh, you name it. Mm-hmm. And it was quite an honor for an old country boy from a little town in Missouri. And so I was elated, happy, and all set to go, and World War II started. Next thing I know, they were knocking on my door to join the military.
Yeah, yeah.
Under the draft program. So even though in a small town they were getting everybody. And so I had a private pilot's license I'd gotten when I was at the University of Kansas when I was 16. I went out there and was coaching woodwind ensembles. And I had this private pilot's license as a result of the CPT program that was out there, and some of my friends were doing it. So anyway, I managed to get 6-7 hours in a Piper Cub, and so I thought that would be fine. And my dad had been in the 50th Aero Squadron in World War One, so he signed the papers for me to come in that program, and I did it at 18 and a half, I think it was, when I came in. Of course, with the war on, and the war started in 41, December 41, so I enlisted in 42 as an aviation cadet and went to Pensacola and all the other basic trainings. And received my wings and went to operational and Hellcats and went out to the Pacific and flew off the three Jeep carriers, the Montana Kyle Case and Bay and Thetis Bay and the Ranger and the Saratoga, the old ones. But the only one I was in combat was Yorktown, and unfortunately my squadron lost a third of its fighter squadron.
That was the CV-10 Yorktown?
CV-10, not five. Five was sunk at Midway.
Yeah.
CV-10 was a fighting lady, known as the fighting lady. And when the war came to conclusion, we thought we were coming back, but they kept us over.
But now, wait a second, Captain Boston. You actually saw quite a bit of combat, didn't you?
Well, I lost a third of a squadron, put it that way. Normally, they bring you out of combat. They had enough intelligence in those days about trauma and combat fatigue that flying off a carrier wasn't that difficult if you had a few hours. But at the same time, some of our people, one particular lad I remember, was highly strung, and he got shot down in a dogfight. But anyway, when the war ended, we thought we were on our way back anyway before the war ended, but they kept us over, and I was flying over Missouri the day they had us fly over when they signed a peace treaty. And make the Japanese think we had 10,000 planes in there, and actually there were only about 450 of us that were coming over the horizon, coming back and circling about two or three times. But that was just a show for show, and I've got a few pictures of that. But anyway,
but now you had actually flown over Tokyo doing photo reconnaissance.
Oh, yeah. Well, the first strike on Tokyo, our skipper in the squadron got killed, and from then on, about every other day, we'd hit for 3 days and run out of fuel and ammunition, so we'd go back to where we called it a train. They had some supply transports and rearm and refuel in those 2 days, while all of us who were ship's company, while we had a few elbows turned up to relax us and then back again after two days off. Well, mm-hmm. Back again for three more days. But anyway, came back to the States.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again. I know you're probably like my dad. You don't like to talk about World War II, but I just wanted to emphasize for the record that you have a lot of experience in combat and that you know what an attacked a vessel looks like.
Oh yeah. So I mean, I'm putting myself on a pinnacle with the great ones, but I flew with the great ones, put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went out, when we boarded, we were replacement type pilots in a way, except we were qualified in a top secret photo reconnaissance where we go in, four of us, and map like we could make one sweep across an island like Iwo Jima.
Mm-hmm.
And we had intervalometers in the plane and K-17, 12, and 24-inch cameras, depending on what altitude we thought we'd be that day. And fly an echelon, come back, and they'd process the film and shoot it back to Guam, where Nimitz had his... And we were doing everything from photographing that area and east of Tokyo, which was wherever they were going to land.
Yeah,
we knew that. That was the plains there, the flat place, but that's where they expected about 1 million troops to get killed if they did. But anyway, yes, we hit Tokyo and hit Miho and all the way up to northern Hokkaido or southern Hokkaido and lost one of my friends there, and then over the China Sea and all over the place in the Philippines. We hit some places there. But anyway, the war ended, so we were thinking coming back, but they kept us out there until October the 27th, which was then Navy Day, and the war ended, of course, September, I think, the 2nd. And so by the time we got back, everybody had forgotten the war, just seemed like, and because we came under the Golden Gate Bridge in New York town at Alameda, and there was only one guy walking across it. We thought they'd be lined up waving, but anyway, that was a typical reaction from people after they were so happy the war was over. So I couldn't get separated in inactive reserve. I mean, you're not discharged as an officer. You were separated, and then you're subject to recall as a reserve officer.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't be separated there in California because the pipeline was so full of people that the whole fleet had come back in. So
they said,
you'll have to go to the East Coast. Sent me to Norfolk, Comair Lant from Comair PAC to Comair Lant. I reported in, and they said, well, you have to wait maybe a couple of months. Well, I wanted to get back to school, and I thought I was going to go back to Curtis, but after I talked to Gomberg, he said he'd see that. Curtis cuts off the students coming in at the age 21, but I was 23 then. And so he said he'd make a call, and he did. And he said, well, go down and talk to Tabuto, who's Prince Lobos in Philadelphia, Orchestra, and he was the one who taught Harold Gomberg at Curtis. And I went down, talked to him, and he said he said, you'll have to start over again here.
Oh, my God.
4.5 years after I had played an oboe, and
yeah,
which made sense, but now I could see these young kids walking around in Lord Fauntleroy outfits, 15, 14, 12 years old, geniuses, and I said, boy, I'm an old timer, I'm an old worn-out fighter pilot here. And I started saying, well, I don't know. And Gomberg said, well, if you do, I'll finish Curtis, I'll see that you get a first chair in Major Symphony, which he was very influential. At that time, he was a solo with New York Philharmonic. He'd moved from St. Louis to New York, and he was the best, finest, outstanding oboist in the world ever had, I think. And, in fact, Time Magazine wrote him up that way. So, anyway, I went back to Norfolk, where I was supposed to be separated. I had to wait, and it said 2 months, so they put me in a Cashew 21 Ferry Squadron, and I was ferrying Hellcats and Corsairs. We were giving them away to schools down in the South, or we were sending them out to Graveyard in Arizona, different places. So I'd lead a bunch of young nuggets, they called them, right out of flight training. I was waiting to get out, too, and we'd take off and head for where we're going to take the planes. Mm-hmm. And on the way, a party every place, had a good time, and got to the destination and come back commercial. And I was saving I was living on per diem. I thought, boy, this is great. And I never had shore duty, but the next thing, they called me, and after about 2 months, wasn't quite in the middle of a semester, and said, your number's up. Come on over and get separated. And I knew that there were a lot of people in that squadron, in that reserve, in that ferry squadron, that were extending their separation so they could get that few bucks that they were getting for easy money. And so I said, well, I can't get back in school for a couple of 3 months. And William and Mary had just a semester system. So I said, well, I'll extend for a couple of months or whatever the time frame was to put me over. So when I got out, I could matriculate and go into school at William and Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, great. And I remember this female wave walked around behind a half wall there and came back with a set of orders. And I said, hey, well, what's that? And she said, we need you on the midway. It's going to shake down cruise. It's just
oh, my goodness.
And I need an experienced fighter pilot. I said, look, I want to stay here. I haven't had shorty. I've been on all darn carriers. Well, not darn, but it would not be nice to have a party routine on that ferry squadron. It's great.
Yeah.
So anyway, she said, nope, in order to get the order, goodbye. So I left and went up to Charlestown, Rhode Island, where they were in training. And I reported in, and the old skipper, bald-headed old boy, mean nasty, and also the keg was sort of nasty, too. But they were just victims of war, I guess, World War II. And so I said, my uniforms weren't exactly the finest because I'd been, I wasn't about to buy new ones. And,
yeah, right.
Anyway, I checked in with him there at the Quonset Hut in Charlestown, Rhode Island, the air station. And a lieutenant commander who just finished flight training was checking in at the same time. So I had a couple of log books, and he had just gotten out of flight training. So this skipper, I won't mention his name, I think he's still alive. Maybe not. But anyway, he said, okay, Boston, go and get a plane and head down to Martha's Vineyard and check out and do some field carrier. You've had all this carrier experience, you won't have any problem. But he said, we have to have 6 or 8 landings just to show you still got to know what you're doing. And so I had to go and have a tooth, a wisdom tooth extracted. Well, it was a difficult, they chiseled it out finally, and had it packed with cotton. So I went out and got a plane, flew down to Martha's Vineyard, made one pass, LSO out there, and then Roger, it wasn't any problem taking as a response to the LSO and grabbing what looked like a wire and taking it off. And you're supposed to do that about 8 times, and then you went back and you were qualified. And when I gave it to Gung and took off, I felt something sticky, and I looked down, my Mae West was covered with blood.
Uh-oh.
And my tooth, where they'd taken the tooth out, the socket was hemorrhaging.
The pressure was probably doing something.
Yeah, well, yeah, or grabbing or hitting the deck, because you always stalled in when you hit.
Yeah.
Okay. And I got back to, and I said, boy, I'm going to be lucky to stay here. And so I went out to the dentist, and they packed it again. I said, are you grounding me? He said, no, he said, Midway's got a bunch of dentists, and they did. So I, next day, I was on the Midway, and heading South America, and came back 2 months later, and finally got out and went back to school. But
I've had several of my my teeth worked on by carrier dentists, actually. The carriers used to come into Marseille, and I always thought that the Navy dentists were better than the French dentists.
Oh, yeah. So. Well, the dentists were good, and they had excellent, I mean, not excellent, but adequate facilities for normal things. But anyway.
Well, anyhow, let's skip ahead. So
yeah.
So then you were you went to William & Mary and got your law degree. And then you were with...
So I went through the fast course. In other words, I needed some credits. I had enough in music and everything else, but I didn't have a degree. So they cranked me through in about a semester and a half, or maybe two semesters. Well, it had to be more. I guess two semesters. Ended up with my AB, and in fact, the Sir Christopher Wren building, I remember, that's the oldest academic building in the country, and that we sat on wooden benches, and it was a good experience. But then I started law school, and my junior year, which was the second year, the dean could recommend it in your junior year. In those days, you could take the bar if the dean recommended the law school did.
Oh, yeah.
And he recommended me and three others, four of us, to go up to Richmond and take the bar, and we did, 1949.
And so then you could skip the third year? Is that the way it worked?
Well, I was in my second year, ready to go in my third year when I took the bar, thinking, I thought, well, hell, I better take it. No, I won't pass it. I'll just take it, and then I'll know what I'm doing the next time.
Right.
And luckily, I passed it. And two of us passed it, and two didn't out of the four. And the guy I passed it with, he was from the area. Dad owned a lot of land up in New Kent County, so I ended up going in partnership with him that senior year, and we were having a lot of fun. So that was the major part of my, when I say, practice before I went in the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in, because he had all kinds of friends, relatives that needed legal help, and we were in court all the time. But anyway, so I had applied when I was in the Navy, before I got out of the Navy, when I decided I wasn't going to go to back to music. I wrote a letter to Mr. Hoover and asked what I needed to become an FBI agent. I got a form letter back. It was nice, but it said needed to be admitted to the highest court accredited from a degree from an accredited law school, admitted to the highest court of the state, and let's see, that was it. So anyway, I went to law school. So I put in for that, thinking I wasn't going to stay around practicing law. I put in for the Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I finished, it was practically done with law school. And just before I got my law, well, I was practicing law, but I had put in for it just about that time.
Right.
And I was very comfortable. I said, well, if I don't make it, I'll stay here. Well, I went down one day. I was flying weekend warriors, I told you, on one weekend a month. And I went down to Norfolk FBI office and took the exams and did everything required. I forgot to tell the skipper of the squadron I was going to go in. I thought I'd just go down and put my name in. And they kept me and put me through all the tests and interviews. And I didn't get back till the end of the day. And the skipper thought I was dead, or UA or what. I always remember he chewed me out. And he said, the next time, tell me where you're going. I said, well, I would have if I'd known I was going to be gone that long. But anyway, I did get a letter saying I had been appointed in the FBI. Well, I had also put a letter into the Navy Department when I heard that they were opening a JAG program.
Mm-hmm.
And they called it law specialist in those days. We didn't have a JAG Corps. And I put it in for that. And I got the FBI letter 2 days before the other one. And so when I told Bill Richards, my partner, I said, Bill, I think I could stay here forever and enjoy it, but I think I want to try that FBI bit. So 2 days later, I got a letter from the Navy telling me to come to Washington and be interviewed for that program. So I talked to my wife about it. We'd been married when I was a junior, and just before I took the bar, we got married. And I said, I think I'd rather go try the FBI. I know the Navy, and I like the Navy, but I'd like to see what the Bureau is all about. So that's the reason I went in, went through the Quantico FBI Academy, ended up in San Francisco, my first office, for a year, enjoyed it immensely. It was a great place to be. It was good food, good everything. We didn't have any kids. And then I got transferred in 1 year, which was normal for new agents, to Los Angeles. Well, that was a different cup of tea. It was a different environment. And it wasn't, it was all right. I would have probably stayed in the Bureau the rest of my career, except Korea enticed me. And then I heard about the Navy and the JAG. Well, we didn't have JAG, but the Navy was bringing in new lawyers to replace some of these that were getting over in the teeth. And so I called JAG and sent him a letter, got a note back saying that as soon as Congress appointed me in the regular Navy, an appointment in the regular Navy, I'd receive a set of orders. And I didn't know, and they came through quicker than I thought they would, so I had a heck of a time. I had to explain I was getting out. And Mr. Hoover had an agreement with the Secretary of the Navy that no FBI agents would be recalled to active duty after I'd been in the Bureau 6 months. Mm-hmm. And so I was a reserve, and I got around that by not being recalled. I went in the regular Navy.
So you had to appeal to be released.
Yeah, and so... But I had to write a letter that satisfied everybody that I wasn't making an end run. I didn't. I just said I was personal reason. I want to get back to practice law rather than being an investigator, which was true. And so I went. They sent me to justice school, and then halfway through the school, they said we need you out in Korea. So I didn't even finish the justice school, and headed out to Admiral C. Turner Joy's staff at Tokyo. But I did a lot of work in Korea and Tokyo, and it was a good 2 years there. And the day I left to come back to the States, the Korean thing ended, July of 1953.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So that, and then, of course, I had the rest of my 35 years after flying in the week as a fighter from actually 42 to 49 or 50, and the rest of the 35 years I spent as a law specialist, and then in 68, the JAG Corps came in, and I retired in 77.
So in 1967, then, you were in Naples, I guess, right?
I was in Naples. I was a captain. I was a senior lawyer, we were the country representative, being a senior U.S. national.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody, Coast Guard, Army, Navy, anybody, we handled it. I was the only lawyer on the Comfair Med staff, but I had handled that. Go to the embassy and argue with them if they wanted to do something against us, or call somebody and tell them to get their person out of the country, or they'd go to the Poggio Reale for not respecting the Italian flag. They had a lot of funny rules over there, but I managed to keep people from being incarcerated. And I had, when I was in Tokyo, I helped write the status of force agreement, so I understood that fairly well, because I was on the criminal jurisdictional committee in mm-hmm. Tokyo before they signed a peace treaty with Japan in 1952, and I don't mean the peace treaty, the giving back their sovereignty, and the State Department, in their inevitable wisdom, gave them back their sovereignty May the 1st, when you know what that day is, Communist National Holiday. So I got caught in a damn riot going from my headquarters back to my BOQ.
Back to 1967 then. So the Israeli attack on the Liberty happens on the 8th of June.
Right.
And how soon after that was JAG brought into it for the investigation?
Well, I'll run it through it. Hurry. When the attack was going on, I was a fair med, and I went up to OPCON Center to hear the little bit we were receiving, an incident to one of our ships being under fire. But, of course, the first jet shot off the antennas, and they didn't have any way of communicating until this old chief rigged up a jury rig that ran a wire from one mast to the other. And I think he did it even while under fire.
And they were being jammed as well.
Oh, yeah. Everything. They intended. There were no question. They didn't want that. But anyway, I heard a little bit. So that night, I'm about 2 in the morning, I get a call, and my wife answers the phone on her side of the bed and says, some admiral wants to speak with you. And it was Admiral Kidd, who was over at the, he was assigned to the NATO Allied, half-south, we called Allied Forces, Southern Europe, NATO, had a four-star admiral, mm-hmm. and Griffin and Horatio Rivero relieved him. And Admiral Kidd called me, and in a deep voice at Ward, you know anything about liberty? And I knew what he's talking about. I said, well, yes, I know, but I heard a little bit, but it's not a secure phone. He said, I know it. I just wanted to tell you, get your bags packed. We've got to go to London. And I said, he called him Jack McCain, Admiral McCain, four-star admiral up there. I think it's Navier. I said, Jack, of course, I kid was from a long tradition naval family. His father was the first admiral killed in Pearl Harbor, still entombed in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And he was well-known all through. His family is well-known, of course. And I said, going to London, so get your bag. And so I said, well, I didn't really want to get involved because I had a couple of personal reasons I didn't want to. But I said, Admiral, I'll have to review this case when it comes across my desk from a 6 feet or before.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I've already cleared with Jack. We're going 20 minutes. And so 20 minutes later, we were on the plane heading up to London. Got into his office, at McCain's office, and he's a little feisty guy. And I had already known that he fired people to drop a hat if they didn't perform, which didn't bother me because I was old. But then been a captain, I said, well, it can't hurt me. I go home, I guess. If I get and somebody pulls something like that, I'm not going to compromise my convictions for anybody. But anyway, he said, what are we going to do? Well, I had to do a lot of fast thinking. I said, well, Admiral, three or four ways you can do it. A simple investigation just to find out what happened, or a board of investigation, and not under oath, or a court of inquiry, put people under oath. And he said, well, what do you recommend? I said, I think we ought to have a formal with the people under oath, so we don't have to go through another Article 32 or anything. We'll have it if it ends up with a court-martial. And so he said, well, let me check. And he called Leominster's office, and Leominster was Saint-Cyr, which is over all of the people in Europe. And Leominster wasn't there, General Leominster, but his deputy, a four-star Air Force, and he wasn't quite certain what to do, and he said, let me check with my JAG. 10 minutes later, called back and said, you take it, meaning they didn't want it. So Admiral McCain said, okay, you guys got it. And I said, well, Admiral, I don't have a staff. I'm just here with Admiral Kidd. And he said, that's all right. You can take my chief. Here was a court reporter. And the old chief, I thought, was going to faint because he was, I think, enjoying sort of a honeymoon there in London away from military protocol, so to speak, except writing letters for him occasionally. And the old chief got his stand on my ass, and so then I said, well, while we're here, maybe we should get the message traffic. And so they already indicated who of the captains on the staff there would be a part of the court.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I called this Captain Raish, I think was his name, R-A-I-S-H or something like that. And, of course, he wasn't prepared to be testifying. So I could see, and I said, well, look, get all the message traffic together. Oh, in the meantime, Admiral McCain had already said, and I said, Admiral, what time frame do we have to run this court of inquiry?
Now, Captain Boston, let me ask you, just to interject a moment, what was the nature of the traffic? Were you seeking access to all?
All traffic.
All yes. Traffic.
Everything from JCS, because the USS Liberty was under the operational control of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But it was under the administrative control, naturally, of the Sinkus Navier, working on down 6 feet and using them. But they had sort of bifurcation there of orders. In other words, JCS would tell them where to move out, and they didn't. That was one thing we found out, that they weren't getting their messages in time. They were going one message that should have really put them about 50 miles out instead of 15.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they were out a little further. I would go back. I haven't bothered to look at that for so many years. But
I think Bamford discusses that a little bit in the chapter on the Liberty in his book, how the traffic was slow getting to them and the distance that they were from shore and so forth. But yeah,
but mm-hmm. the one message went to, I think, the Philippines. And then, of course, they were way on the other side of the world. And by the time it came back, I think it was supposed to have gone through Crete down, or maybe rode it to Crete and down, or maybe it rode it to them. I don't know. But anyway, every time these messages, they were always late. But they started out well within the extraterritorial limits. They weren't in the Israeli or the Egyptian waters. They were outside. And and going back and forth, I think 15 miles at about 5 knots.
Okay, no, just hang on a second, Captain Watson. Let's stay with your experience there in London with.
Well, anyway, I said, how long do we have, Admiral,
to
run this? Because I wanted to have some feeling about if I had to put a staff together. And he said, 1 week. And, you know, I say he's come out with these staccato blasts sometimes. 1 week, back here in 1 week. And so, well, I'll come back with what I got, I guess, in 1 week. What's that?
At that point, Captain Boston, did you begin to wonder whether the fix was in on this?
No. I was an innocent lamb as far as, except I knew that little bit I had heard, but I was very objective. I wasn't in any mood or thinking the Israelis intentionally attacked one of our ships. And not that I was brainwashed by their APAC or whatever they used as a propaganda machine, but I had other things to worry about rather than the Israeli problem. But I was completely objective when he said 1 week, and so we took off. I told that Captain Wright Race, the Assistant Chief of Staff for Communications, to have his messages all in order so I could put them in a hurry, one after another, whatever was pertinent. And so we took off. Flew down to Crete, Chief and Admiral Kidd and I, and boarded Berry, USS Berry, a destroyer, rode it out, rendezvoused with Liberty, and it was practically dead in the water.
Yeah.
And they had a big hole on the side where the torpedo had gone in and killed 25. We still had the 25 bodies in there. But they had cleaned the top side up pretty well. They had 800 holes in it, but from the stack down, but they'd cleaned most of the blood and guts and all the heads and legs, and the injured had been heloed off. So we climbed over the hole in the side and went up Jacob's Ladder and up to Commander McGonagall, the captain's ship's cabin. He was there lying in his sack with a hole in his leg, and I don't remember the time. It seems like it was sometime around 2 or 3 in the morning, but it could have been even 4 or 5. Anyway, it was early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I shook hands with him, and he winced when I did. And I thought, I'm not that strong. Maybe he's just weak. And the next morning, he commented, he said, when you shook hands with me, I had a piece of shrapnel I didn't know was in there popped out. So anyway, introducing ourselves, what we're going to be. We were going to be there riding her back for the next 2 days or whatever. And a damage control assistant comes running in, a young ensign. I thought it was JG, but somebody told me recently it was an ensign, and named Scott. And he said, Captain, I think the ship's going to break in two. And I said, oh, boy, here we go. Because I remember from the Yorktown days, my cabin, they used to laugh and say it was Torpedo Junction. If we took a torpedo in Yorktown, I'd be swimming. So I said, here I'm, old man here. I wasn't an old man, but I was old in that sense.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll be swimming tonight, I guess. But anyway, this young ensign was good. I mean, he was remarkable, and he got all the mattresses he could find on the ship that weren't available, and had some big timbers that I didn't know they carried, but he used those to support that thin wall that's between the ocean that was in that coming in from that hole, because the hole was half up and half down the waterline. And he kept that wall until we got back to Malta.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of days, steaming, as I recall. And, of course, we had a Navy trawler and a Russian trawler behind us. And I believe a couple of destroyers riding gun on us. But we got in dry dock in Malta. And a great big canvas screen they had around the dry dock to keep the Russians from seeing the ship. I don't know why, because it wasn't anything to hide, I could see. But so we were there, and the other two captains came in from London, and so we convened the court of inquiry there on the ship. And I started out, as I remember, with the commanding officer, Commander McGougall, who we recommended. I didn't, but the court did, because all I was doing was putting stuff together. The court recommended he get the Medal of Honor, which he did. But I understood from my kid that the Israelis objected to him, and so they ended up giving him the Medal of Honor in the gun factory, and the Secretary of the Navy,
right,
instead of the President of the United States, who he was the only one, I understand, in the history of the Medal of Honor. And, you know, it's called, people call it Congressional, it's the Medal of Honor, but the Navy has its own, but it's the only time it's never been given, ever been given, other than in the President's office, in the President of the United States office by him.
Yeah, some people say it might as well have been awarded to him at midnight under the 16th Street Bridge. I mean, it was really quite a disgraceful.
Yeah, yeah. It was completely, no notoriety. I don't know, I can't say from my recollection, but what I've heard, I mean, I don't have any knowledge, but I believe there wasn't any even a release about it. But anyway, you know, whenever the lad got one the other day posthumously, and it was in the newspapers. But anyway, we ran the court there for 2 days.
Now, before the court had actually convened, I suppose that you were already pursuing informal discussions with surviving crew.
Absolutely. I wouldn't put anybody on our oath under any condition if I, as an investigator or as an FBI or otherwise, unless I had a feeling for what they were going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you put them under oath, sometimes they get nervous. But when I try court martials, I always had a rule. I'd talk to any witness, for either the government or the defense, at least 3 times, 3 different days.
Mm-hmm.
Ask them the same question, and if they give you the same answer 3 days in a row, well, you can feel fairly confident. Even if they get nervous on the stand, you can refresh their memory or refer to what mm-hmm. they had said and bring it out the way they said it, which is normally telling the truth. So I first thing I did, I ran 3 courts of inquiry for Admiral McCain and Kidd, 2 others after that. And I learned that I, Kidd, was traveling at high speed emotionally, not emotionally, but put everything he had into everything, and he usually got sick the first day. And it would take a lot of penicillin, whatever it was, to get him back on his feet. And anyway, he was out for the first morning, I think, as I remember. He wasn't very active. And I had all the witnesses I could find that was available who weren't dead or taken off the ship because of physical condition. I think it was something like 20 or 22 witnesses.
Yeah.
But people down below decks didn't have too much to say other than the fact they were scared to death, especially when they saw their buddies all dead.
Yeah.
But the ones topside did a good job of filling me in when I put them under. I talked to them. And, you know, there's somebody said, I mean, we took a lot of heat, Admiral Kidd and I did, because, of course, when you put somebody on the stand, and when they finish their testimony, you admonish them, don't talk about this until it's been released as part of the official record, either in Navy or civilian or any time.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, DA tells them, witnesses that. Well, anyway, I tell these lads, don't talk. And we were in Malta then, see, and they were going ashore. And some of the old chiefs were being wined and dined by the newspaper people, trying to get them to talk. And I guess after a few of them got a little drunk, they said, well, yeah, they told us we couldn't talk. Well, I told them not to talk till after this record was completed, after the investigation was completed. But that was before we were told, or I was told by Admiral Kidd, that the President and McNamara both said, this is lid on it, don't talk to anybody, which is true then. But when I was taking the testimony, or talking to these kids,
mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to warn them then because they weren't under oath when I was asking what they knew.
Mm-hmm.
So then when I put them on the stand, and then under oath they'd tell me the same story, then when it finished, I'd just say, you should not talk about this to anybody till after the matter is resolved. And it would make sense. I mean, that's the way the law works. And except for those who got drunk ashore and said that we were forcing them not to talk because they misunderstood, I guess, that part. But anyway, 2 days, I got back on his feet.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were 3 people from JCS came in sometime during that period. And, of course, by that time I was running on low fuel in my... I was trying to get some rest once in a while, but he recessed it to the court because he was told that 3 flag officers, Army, JAG, Army or Navy, Air Force, General Flag, from JCS. And so he went out, talked to them, came back in and said, Ward, I said, we do have the authority to keep this going, don't we? I said, absolutely, it's our jurisdiction. He said, well, these people in JCS indicated they wanted to take it over. And I said, well, it's our baby right now, and when we're finished, if they want to run again, well, that's all right. But right now, we've been given the convening authority's action, which is over this area, to investigate the circumstance attendant with the damage and death and injuries to the Navy. And so he went back out and told them, and they left in a huff, he said. They weren't happy. But anyway, we finished what we could take there and then Liberty, flew back to London, had about 20 typists waiting.
Now you had taken testimony from, you said, about 20 or 30 survivors of the Liberty crew.
Yeah, they were aboard the Liberty when I, there were 65 later that, the Jim Annas and some of them, a lot of people, and Jim had a right to say that, but if there was about 65, I understand by the numbers they quote, that we didn't bother to call. Well, that 1 week was almost all shot by the time we went back to London. There wasn't any way we could skip around the Mediterranean or the carriers where they were or any place else to take statements. We had enough testimony to indicate that it was intentional, I mean, in our opinion, because Admiral Kidd and I'd talk after the during our breaks, and of course, you've heard me say before, I'm sure, that he referred to them, and I do too, as murderous bastards, and then they intended to kill everybody they shot, and wasn't a mistake, and shoot all the antennas down, and all the flags, and the ship was well marked, and AGR-5, and had even had his name on it. But anyway, we got back to London, and they had about 20 typists ready. And the old chief, with his stenomask, would dictate a rough page, and they'd grab it. And as soon as he'd finish another one, grab one. And they finished up their record that night, 640 pages, I believe, something like that. And Ike took it to Washington, and that's where, and I went back to Naples, and when he was in Washington, he was there about probably 2 weeks, but any place from 10 to 20 days, I don't know. I wasn't running a time on him. But when he came back, the first thing he did, he was call me on the phone from FSL. And he said, Ward, in deep voice, they aren't interested in the facts or the truth. It's a political matter, and we've been told by the President and the Secretary of Defense to put a lid on it and don't talk to anybody, and that means anybody, about this matter. Well, I observed that for 35 years. And this lad yesterday who called me from the Chicago Tribune said, well, why did you violate your order? I said, I thought that was a little naive to ask me a question like that after I had already gone on record when the Navy Times called me in June of 2002. And when they said, did I have an opinion? And I said, yes. And they said, what is it? I said, an opinion is a deliberate attack. And as I've told you, or you've probably read from other interviews, when Navy Times, I think his name was Jordan, Jordan was the lad's name. And so 2 weeks or a week later, whenever the next edition came out, second or third page headline, two skeptics.
Well, let me just quote from an article, February 17, 2004, in the San Diego Union-Tribune, your hometown paper, by James Crawley.
Yeah.
And the title is, Ex-Officer Alleges Cover-Up and Probe of Spy Ship Attack. And the quote here is, Boston's cover-up allegation is enormously significant, said author James Bamford, who has written several books about the super-secret National Security Agency, which analyzed radio intercepts from Liberty and other U.S. surveillance ships. Quoting Bamford now, it's equivalent to former Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren coming out and saying the Warren Commission report on the Kennedy assassination, everything we said was not what we believed, but we were pressured to say it, Bamford said. Quote, it puts an enormous shadow over everything that was in the Navy report, he said. So it's recognized by people who are really the top civilian experts on the NSA. Your public statements now are seen as critically important for getting the story right. And it's, I mean, just to try to put this into some perspective, you've got another quote here from the ship's physician who writes about the Board of Inquiry. Never before in the history of the United States Navy has a Navy Board of Inquiry ignored the testimony of American military eyewitnesses and taken on faith the word of their attackers. It really is quite an amazing thing. And then just to go back to what you were saying about the official transcripts and so forth, you're talking about Admiral Kidd bringing them back to Washington, and then eventually, of course, the transcripts were released, and you noticed that the transcripts that went back to Washington had your hand-corrected initial pages, but the transcripts released did not have that. And in particular, just to take one point, but an important point, you note that the testimony of Lieutenant Lloyd Painter concerning the deliberate machine gunning of the life rafts by the Israeli torpedo boat crews, which you distinctly recall being given at the Court of Inquiry and was included in the original transcript, was then missing. And that's important. I mean, all those sorts of things are important, right?
Well, you have to remember that Doctor was very heroic. He was injured in the attack, but he performed his medical duties for, I guess, about a day without even rest. And, and of course, all of these allegations about and not getting, about not taking testimony, that's what I'm referring to, the 65 that were taken off the ship that I would love to have been able to ask. But they were all over the place and in terrible physical condition. One poor lad, I guess, had about 8 or 9 operations on his rear end before it was over. But those were the people that they felt we'd ignored, and we wouldn't. But some people have said that I kid told them to stop talking about the matter. I don't remember, and I would be truthful in saying if I had heard him say that, I would have questioned it. I don't remember him telling anybody to not talk about. I mean, if somebody, I read it in some, or I don't know who said it. But somebody said that they were going to tell their story, and he shut them up and said, we're not interested in that. Wasn't that kind of person. In fact, if he did anything, he'd expand on what they were saying and really insisted to get the answer that they were meant to give if they weren't giving it clearly. But unless they were wandering off, and I don't remember that ever happening, but if it did, maybe I missed it. And say if they have, I always started the questioning. I mean, that's the way you do as the counsel of court. And I had my questions. And then when I finished my questions, which were sometimes lengthy and sometimes not, depending on where I thought the lad were, what their testimony would result in after I heard it. And so then I let them off the stand. I had to. That was proper procedure, turn them over to the court. Question.
Well, let's go over the incident itself a little bit, if we can, please, Captain Boston. At the time, and then in retrospect, what's the sequence of events as you understand them?
Well, you mean as far as the Israelis?
Yeah, as far as the attack.
Look, 40 years ago, but I've. And I really didn't get back to refreshing my memory on this until 5 years ago when Christa wrote his book.
Uh-huh.
And then that's when I came out when I told you the Navy Times had called me and asked me. And,
right,
and after I heard of what he was defending them, he had tried to talk with me 2 times and I wouldn't talk to him. And that's when I referred him to Admiral Kidd. And I think it was 1990. And Kidd calls me back after first time either one of us had talked with him, and I didn't. I refused to talk about liberty, and so I called him back and said, "I think that guy is a Israeli agent." I always clearly remember that, and I said, "Well, Admiral, it sounded like that to me the way he was trying to get in." But he made a career out of about 10 years of going to Israel and getting everything he could get. He got everything that the Israelis could give him, apparently, and he made many trips there. There are other people who know more about him than I do, other than I wouldn't talk to him. And then, of course, when Admiral Moore asked me to come back and testify at the Rayburn Building, I sent my affidavit instead because I can't fly anymore on my knees. I can't.
Well, I'm not sure how important Crystal is in this whole affair, in the sense that the number of people who have direct experience and were in a position to know something about it, so much outnumber those who take an opposite view. In fact,
a young lady by the name of Belinda Henley, I think, called me right at the beginning, right after Navy Times said that I came out, and so did Richard Helms, who was then the CIA director and a great man in my book. I didn't know him personally, but I had a lot of respect for what I knew about him. And he came out of the closet, too, and he said, yes, it was delivered, but he was told not to talk about it. But here he said, I'm not going to say anymore. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in court. Well, that doesn't bother me, talking about going to court. But the thing is that I wasn't. But this guy from the, and this lad from the Chicago Tribune kept asking me, said, well, why did you do it after all those years? I said, because it's overtaken by events. When Crystal wrote his book and had a few high-ranking officers say, it looks like that's the facts, those are the facts that we believe in, or something towards that effect, I got very upset over that, because who are those people? They weren't involved. Let me read one thing before you're on the record here before
okay. We
end up. And I don't know this gentleman, but I sure would like to meet him. His name is Smith, S-M-Y-T-H, David Smith. And this is in the U.S. Naval Institute proceedings for July 2003. Somebody gave a copy of it to me, and that's the reason I have it. As a retired newsman and editor of the Associated Press, I read David Walsh's article with great interest. About 20 years ago, I did an AP story on the Liberty incident that was published by the Los Angeles Times and a large number of other U.S. newspapers. I spoke to the following officials. Their titles corresponded to the positions they occupied at the time of the incident, and they all told me that the Israeli attack was delivered, not an accident. Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Thomas Moore, Central Intelligence Agency Director Richard Helms, National Security Agency Deputy Director Louis Tortorella. I still would like to know what led them to this unanimous conclusion, but obviously you have no hope of finding out by questioning the nation's top intelligence and security officers. The information is classified, and they're not going to tell you. I was, however, struck by the fact that they all stated their conclusions clearly, forcefully, and without any qualifications, hedging, or ambiguities. Because they had at their disposal the intelligence gathering capabilities of the State Department, the CIA, and the NSA, I presumed that they had solid grounds for their conclusion. I might add that I gathered other statements. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara told me on the phone that he had, quote, no recollection of the attack on the Liberty. I found this curious at the time, as I understood him to have a reputation on the matter of the filing cabinet memory. I also talked to Admiral Isaac Kidd, who headed the Naval Court of Inquiry. I told him what the others had said, and then asked if he had an opinion. He said, quote, the giants of that time can speak out. I know when to keep my mouth shut. 36 years have gone by since the Liberty was attacked. Is it not time for U.S. government agencies to release whatever classified information is in their files and clear this matter up once and for all? Well, there's a perfect example of people saying the same thing I said.
Yeah.
And then I've been called everything from a liar to being senile, and perhaps I am. I'm not a liar, but I might be weak in the brain sometimes, but I try not to be, and I remember things pretty well that are indelible in my memory that shocked me. It shocked me when I boarded Liberty and saw the condition, 800 holes. I mean, that ship would look like a piece of Swiss cheese, and that hole that we climbed on, carrying 25 bodies back to Malta, and seeing them brought out of the hole without heads, there's a good example, Crystal. When he tried to talk to me, asked me, I wouldn't talk about the Liberty, but I told him my background. And he said, well, you any Well, at some way or another, he got it out of me that I saw these old chief bringing out bodies. I mean, they were going down in the hole and bringing his body. And this one chief, he was crying. And he had his buddy, his head was stuck on the overhead and without a head, but hanging there by his neck. And when he saw that, he just about, he came up crying, and then he started vomiting. Well, Crystal made some reference to me one time saying that I vomited. I didn't have any personal feeling. I've seen cadavers. I've gone through autopsies with people who have been found in conditions worse than that. I remember one sailor was in scalding water, and they pulled him out. I was there when they pulled him out of the water, and he had tattoos all in his arms and his skin. I mean, everything came off except the bone right in front of me. Mm. But that's not the point. The point is that Crystal made a lot of allegations that I either lied or I'm senile. And if that's all right, he can say it. But if I get on the stand, I'll still tell my story as I know it. And, of course, my wife gets very upset with me being involved so much that and other people. I had an admiral yesterday. Well, I had lunch yesterday with a couple of admirals. Good friends, real fine people. Jake Dog Ramage, he's very much in my side of the story, and Admiral David Richardson, who was Sixth Fleet commander, right after it wasn't during. Bill Martin was during. Now Bill Martin wrote Jake Dog Ramage, and Admiral Ramage told me this yesterday again. He's told me before, but I refreshed his memory. I said, "You said Admiral Martin wrote you, who was then a Sixth Fleet." I said, "What did he? You said you gave this letter." His letter to the Naval Museum down in Pensacola, and yet my friends can't find it down there. Can you remember? Do you remember what he said? He said, well, he was upset because Harry was a Sixth Fleet commander, and he was completely bypassed. Admiral McCain didn't even bring him into the act. Admiral Geist was a carrier division commander. The reason he got involved was because he'd launched planes to go shoot those rascals down that were shooting us.
Yeah.
And they got recalled. And the lad who was flying the planes, he was a good friend of mine right here in San Diego area. And I have lunch with him frequently. His name's Bill Knudsen. And he'd be a good person for you to talk with. K-N-U-D-S-O-N. Anyway, Bill was airborne. And initially when this came out of the closet, he didn't want to get involved. And he wasn't. The only thing he remembered, really remembers, is that he was ready to go. Airborne and on the way, and they called him back. But Admiral Geist, who was the carrier division commander, refused a recall when McNair said it, according to evidence that's been available through the communication routine. And also the fact, I think it's Lieutenant Painter, who Admiral Geist told the story to and made him swear that he wouldn't relate it until after Geist was dead. And now Geist is dead. But anyway.
So where did the recall order come from, do you think?
Well, Johnson primarily was through in McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, because that chief and I think Roder, Port Leode, overheard this because he had to patch him through, and they said McNamara was screaming and Johnson was even worse, and he said he didn't care. Later I heard this. He said he didn't care. 300 sailors died. He wasn't going to go against his ally or something like that. Words to that effect. Terrible. I mean, that's what Admiral Tom Moore, who had been pushing this thing until he died for the last 10 years. He just died, unfortunately. But he called me and wanted me to come back and testify. As I told you, I sent him an affidavit, and he read that, and that's in the congressional record now because they put Thomas Admiral Moore's full thing in the congressional record, including my affidavit. And the person who put it in, not that I'm the same persuasion politically as he is, but I have to admire him. He's the only congressman or senator has I would say, the courage to even think about it.
Was that Adlai Stevenson?
No. It's John Conyers of Michigan.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he would look congressional record. I can give you a citation. You want me to give it to you?
But not right now, but later, please, yes. Well, it is amazing because you have all of these former senior officials, two former directors of the NSA, two former deputy directors of the NSA, former CIA director, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Moore, former chairman, joint chiefs of staff, former chief of naval operations, a long list of people who have impeccable credentials and many who have reasonably direct experience of the incident.
One more name throw in, I wasn't in this list, is Bobby Ray Inman, and he's recognized as being a brilliant. He was a head of an NSA at one time afterwards, and he's gone on record saying, yes, it was deliberate from what reports he was able to read. And that's what I alluded to there in that report.
Yeah.
He said if they ever brought out all the records, it wouldn't be any question.
Here's a quote from Inman. It is just exceedingly difficult to believe that the USS Liberty was not correctly identified.
They're back again in World War II days. We shot up a lot of Japanese boats and ships. You know, a boat, you put a boat on a ship, but you can't do it that way. Going into Tokyo, the first time we were instructed, we were the fighters, and going in, of course, I was in lead there, unit because I was flying a photo, and anything you saw on the deck, sink it. And because they didn't want the Japanese to know that we were on our first strike there in Tokyo. And we shot, I guess, maybe 6 or 8, 10 small vessels that had antennas. Obviously, they all had radios to keep, they were sort of their picket line out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we even sank a 100-ton lugger, as I remember, with just four of us shooting 50 calibers. I mean, from the stern to the bow, four of us lining up, and boy, those 50 calibers with tracers would tear anything up.
I think that there are a couple of important points to pick up on still. And one is that the USS Liberty incident is the only such attack on a U.S. military vessel that has ever not been investigated by the Congress. So let's talk about that. That's one thing. And then secondly, one of the things that you had mentioned in the transcript having been changed, that in the original you had taken testimony from Lieutenant Lloyd Painter concerning the deliberate machine gunning of the life rafts. Well, that is potentially important because if an investigator...
That's a war crime.
That is a war crime for which there is no statute of limitations.
That's right.
Yeah.
Murder.
Yeah.
But back to the record again. I didn't see that until after Jim Ennis sent me a copy when I came out of the closet 5 years ago. And he asked me, I said, no, I haven't seen that since it went. And he, of course, he'd been back on the Freedom of Information Act and gotten copies of everything he could get his hands on, and had looked at the original. And I burned copies, I guess. It had to be a copy because it was almost perfect as far as I could see, except some pages were missing. Some were black, you know, how they black out sentences. And some were excised. In other words, it'd be at the bottom page that says, "Umpty-umps excised," or this page excised. So it wasn't a complete one I had or looked at. And also, I kept flipping pages, reading, expecting to see those. I know I made about 15, at least 15, incorrections from the bottom of one page being AND, the next page AND, AND, where the typist would grab the rough, and the next typist had put the AND. So that was a double, and I was told that Mr. McNamara wouldn't like that. He liked everything perfect.
Yeah.
So I would ran a line through the end at the bottom of the page, put a WB. I didn't see one WB in the whole thing. And besides the excises, and frankly, I wouldn't say I remembered if I didn't, Lieutenant Painter talking about the life rest. And then, of course, who was it? Somebody wrote an article and said that the Israelis had one of those life rafts on display in one of their museums.
I've read that too, yes.
Well, anyway.
So that could be recovered as evidence if this were ever reopened in an investigation, I suppose.
Well, I don't think I did probably throw it away.
Well,
they're not going to hold that out. That would really incense, if you could incense the American public. And I'm not in this doing with the intention of incensing anybody. I'd like to see the survivors, the people, the widows, the children, know that their fathers died as a result of this type of action, and that the six that are in the Arlington should have a marker saying they were killed by an attack by the Israelis. No question. Now, we talk about the 1812 war, that the British burned our capital.
Yeah.
And Williamsburg, my mother and dad came back to see me one time when I was in law school, and my mother went over to the courthouse because she remembered that her great-grandmother, somebody, owned a farm abutting Williamsburg. And Williamsburg, in those days, were just farms that ran up to little, you know, up city limits, like a, when 90% of America were farmers. And she went in the courthouse, and they didn't have any records back past 1812. Well, I think it was 1812 when the British came through Williamsburg and burned the everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so well, we've given that Israelis so much money, and yet we tell them to do that we don't agree with, and they call us anti-Semitic or words like that.
Well, it is amazing that the story of the USS Liberty, although it circulates around now on the internet and before the internet existed around through various underground channels, that the story has never really been mainstreamed, if you will, and that even when people try to mainstream it, one way or another, it gets squashed. You were telling me the other day about somebody from Nightline who came to to interview you about this shortly before the Nightline program went off the air. And
Well, he very nice gentleman. I want to say Marish, I think it was.
Well, yeah, I thought it was probably my friend Dave Marish, and I checked with him yesterday, in fact, and I got an email from him confirming, in fact, that he had done this interview, that he found you very credible, and as to how the story wound up getting spiked, what you told me is that Ted Koppel spiked it, and
well,
Dave
Reed
says,
and I got that information.
Yeah,
I've got a call from Nightline. They wanted to come out and interview and put me on the tape, and my wife had enough of that. She wasn't letting anybody come in the house anymore. And especially now, since we moved from a large house down in the marina up to in the village here, in a smaller house. But anyway, I think I mentioned when I talked with you before that DirecTV is going to be out the 12th, they said, and run a show on me. But and then people call, and I was delighted to talk with you because of your credentials and being a foreign service officer. Well, certainly you are in a position to analyze and feel. Whether it's credible or not, the way I've told the story. But this Nightline, when they said they were coming out, I said, well, you can't come to the house. The last two times that have been in, it's just been disruptive, and my wife's not up to facing that. And so they got a room down at the Marriott Hotel Resort here in town,
mm-hmm.
and it's real nice, and a big conference room type. Went in, and they had a lawyer from L.A. by the name of Ron Goucher, who's very much involved in Liberty. But lately I hear that he's backing off, and he's been getting a lot of static. I asked somebody, well, what's happened to Ron? He used to be so active. And someone said he was backing off now because the Internet has been calling him anti-Semitic, and it's hurting his law practice. Well, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true. I'm just saying that that's what somebody observed is why he hasn't been. But he was the first one to come down and tape me and video me. And we had a good, and he was a former Air Force intelligence officer, and he had been with the Liberty from the beginning as far as saying it was delivered. But anyway, they had him. Nightline had him first after they put it all the makeup on, getting the lights and everything. They had to be just perfect here and there. And then I went on for about an hour or so, and when I finished, and I. Mr. Maris, if that's his name, I think it is. I mean, you've confirmed it.
Yeah.
I thought it was a different name. I mean, close to that, but I phonetically, that's right.
Yeah, Dave Marish, yeah.
Yeah. And
he's now the one of the Washington anchors for Al Jazeera, actually, but yeah.
Well, anyway, he said, Captain, he said, I'm Jewish. And I said, I don't care myself. He said, I'm Jewish, but I think everything you said is true. And he said, he didn't say I agreed with he said it in a way like he agreed, but he gave me a feeling. I mean, he said that he understood, and he felt everything I said was right or true. But he said, I said, well, when are you going to run this on Nightline? I don't watch that normally, but I understand a lot of people do. And because I'm in bed by then, but he said, in a couple of months, I have to go to Israel and get their side. 2 months went by, and I called a lawyer, a friend up in L.A., when's this? Either I called him or he called me. I think I called him and said, what's the status of that Nightline? Do you have any information? Oh, I guess I might have called Ron Gotch. I don't know who I called, but anyway, the answer I got was that they hadn't heard, but they were going to call ABC because they had a contact back there, some friend. They called ABC, and then they called me back and said, it's been spiked by this Ted Koppel.
Right.
So that was the answer I got. So it's never been. It's in the can, I guess, or it's on the floor, but whichever.
Dave confirms that Ted did spike it, quote, to my frustration and sorrow, unquote.
Well, I think right now I had, a vice admiral say that he didn't think this Liberty follow-up is going to go anyplace because of political. I said, my feeling is this. I think the American public is so filled up and so sick and tired of the cover-ups and the misleading statements that they later come out and say, well, that's true, but we didn't know it then. And all kinds of that poor guy,
Libby, yeah.
Yeah, goes to jail, and even though I used to be an FBI agent, and I'd admonish people when I'd take a statement from him, and when they can talk about perjury, but for goodness sake, anybody with common sense knows that what he was doing and the responsibilities and the cases that he was running through, and to have somebody, and I still can't figure out how Novak got out of that act. He exposed it, but he's almost immune. But I don't see where he did anything other than the same old spin. Now that Gergen, I guess when Clinton brought him in, gosh almighty, the way they handled the lies there, it's just pathetic. And of course, the yellow belly senators wouldn't do anything about following through on that.
But let me ask you just a last question, please, Captain Boston. Are you at all optimistic that eventually there will be a full investigation and that there will be some resolution?
Well, I hate to use the word optimism, but I'm not going to run away from it if people still call me. And I think if enough credible people like you get on the horn and so many people. I had people come up to me at the round table, and there are about 200 people belong to. I'm on the board of directors, and I walk around with a microphone, so everybody knows me.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had, I don't know how many yesterday when we had the meeting, and just very flattering. Said a great article, I even had people say I didn't know that, and I said, well, for goodness sake, where were they when Liberty got shot at? But anyway. No, I can't give you any feeling of optimism, but I can say that I think Edmund Burke said that when good people do nothing, evil will prevail. I don't know if I'm a good person, but I'm not going to say I'm going to walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I say a prayer every night, and I'll close this conversation with that if you like, is that I ask God to grant me the serenity to accept those things I cannot change. To give me the courage to change those which I can and should.
And the wisdom to know
the difference. And the wisdom to do it right. And I added a little caveat. Please, when I reach that fork in the road of uncertainty, I beg that you nudge me in the right direction to do what's right. And that's all I can do. And I feel the survivors, when I came out of the closet, I've got a box full of letters, just tearful letters, saying, Captain, you were brave. I wasn't brave. I just got tired of somebody telling a lie against what happened, and it was not only preponderance, but beyond a reasonable doubt. They knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They knew
mm-hmm.
they were killing, and they wanted to sink that ship. And I can talk for everyone on other subjects there I found out about since.
Captain Boston, I very much appreciate your taking the time to talk with me, and I appreciate your speaking out about this. I think it does take a lot of courage actually to do that, and your statements are very helpful to a lot of people, not just the Liberty crew and their families, but I think people across the country who really would like to see some kind of a proper resolution here. So,
well, if nothing else, if we're going to walk away from somebody shooting us and killing us, then we've compromised everything we live for. And, George, I didn't know you, but I had a friend recommend you. And as far as I'm concerned, use this any way you want to use it. And I have full faith that any way you edit it is fine. I know I talked longer than I should, and everybody says, don't ask me a question. You'll be there forever getting an answer. I hope I've answered them, and if I haven't, well, feel free to call me anytime in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Captain Boston. Thank you.
Yep.
What an exemplary person, a good man. And I hasten to add, I understand that Captain Boston is pretty conservative in his outlook, to say the least. That's okay. Despite that, there are large and significant issues where our views very much overlap. Moreover, I dare say Captain Boston might even surprise me, being to the left of me on some things. So, there's not much I can usefully say here about the USS Liberty attack, but three things seem to me important to keep in mind. First, the event must not be forgotten. Too few people know about it. More should. Second, seeing as how war crimes do not have a statute of limitations, I think, however hopeless it may seem right now, that the possibility of war crimes prosecutions must be kept open, at least by those who preserve the history. That possibility is a powerful thing, and may yet find practical uses, even if they never culminate in actual war crimes trials. Or, if they do, then perhaps some other things could be sorted out as well, such as how this story could have been suppressed at all. Which leads to point three. The USS Liberty offers an important lesson about the establishment's ability to toss inconvenient events down the memory hole. That's something that must be resisted at every opportunity, no matter who you are or what you do. Critical thinking is our watchword. Okay, on to the upcoming schedule. Next week, after this short delay, is Jean Bricquemont, a Belgian theoretical physicist who writes frequently on politics from a progressive perspective. Jean's latest book is Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War, available in paper from Amazon for about $12, and I very much recommend it. The Friday following Jean is an exciting interview with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut and the sixth man to walk on the moon. For the past 35 years, roughly, Dr. Mitchell has been researching consciousness as it relates to cosmology and causality. We talk about NASA, space, and consciousness. There's also an extended aside where Dr. Mitchell explains that he grew up on a ranch near Roswell, New Mexico, and that later as an adult and an astronaut, he had the opportunity to talk with the principal characters in the Roswell incident, who he believes. Very interesting, if true. And perhaps something of a new revelation in that saga. Following that, I'm not sure. I need to hustle and figure out programming for late July and August. At this point, there are only two irons actually in the fire. One, a request to an actress to do a show in character, but EP would have to be outrageously lucky for her to agree. Thanks very much to all those who wrote in last week, particularly international listeners. Please feel free to write with whatever's on your mind. I am interested, it's important, and I do write back. And thanks to George in the Netherlands for his kind donation. I really appreciate it. Also, George pointed out to me that some people prefer not to use PayPal. Thus, I've added a button on the donations page that allows you to donate through Google. Please, consider donating. Remember, it's your support that makes these shows possible. Okay, then, that's it for this week. As always, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to talk with all these wonderful people on your behalf. Thank you for listening. And please stay tuned to Electric Politics.